Okay, we're on Daf Ayin Bet Bet. We're on page 72B3 here at the Or Zeruah Talmud class. And we're talking about Katana Rodef, that Rabbi Huna said the situation was a Katana is chasing after a Katan, and remember talking about two witnesses. The two witnesses who see this situation may kill the one who is pursuing the other. Right? We kind of worked that out. Even though, by the way, it didn't explicitly say, here is the situation. Let me give you the facts. Two witnesses are standing by, and they see this happening. And one of them, if both agree that this Katan is chasing that one to kill him, then he may do the following. But that's pretty much the Savara here. That's pretty much the accepted case, that there are two witnesses, because what do you need in Jewish circumstances? You need two witnesses. What do they need to do? They need to agree that the situation is what the situation is. Rashi explains it's a katan that's chasing a katan, and therefore you can kill the pursuer. What's surprising is two things. We said this last time. A minor, first of all, is he responsible for anything, and does he have a sentence of death? Absolutely not. So you actually have a situation in which the minor is put into such a position. And two, generally, you don't have what's considered here to be a very standard principle in capital cases, ein hatara. You don't have any warning. So you don't have a warning when it comes to the pursuer. What does the warning ultimately have to say? What do we say? It says that you have to give a warning, and then the response from the one pursuing has to be like this. I know what the law is, and by the way, I'm still going to do it anyway. So it's an understanding of the law, and it's a, I'm going to be over that law anyway. I'm going to transgress anyhow. And that is considered a warning for most authorities. Actually, that's the standard of the Gemara. There are some questions about the Nusach, about the actual language of what the warning is. And that's really brought out in the Gemara on the bottom of 40b. Now, I'm sorry, our volume doesn't have that page in it. But 40b, our volume, if you're using one of the Art Scroll copies, it doesn't have it.
It's in the first volume.
And that's the one problem when things are done in various volumes, right? That if you don't have a little stack of books in front of you in a set place, you don't have every one of the legal texts. I'm sorry, I didn't get to copy this. So we won't go entirely into it here, but the Gemara over there is trying to learn from language what it is that actually makes the absolute necessity of warning. What's that? Right, of warning really hold. And in that, you have hermeneutical kind of midrashic moves. We won't go into the sukkah because it's not in our volume, but you have midrashic moves to kind of come to this place where we know it holds in all cases of all executions that you need this warning. Now, for a moment, think about what the Gemara is saying, and this is why I wanted to go back here and make a chazara and then talk about some legal philosophy for a second. What area of law are we really dealing with if they're already saying that Rav Huna, at least, is saying, so it seems anyway, that we don't satisfy the requirements we laid out. But in this case, we allow for not the one who's being pursued to turn around and kill him. We allow for the two, quote-unquote, bystanders who become witnesses to actually take this guy's life. What
larger area of law are we talking about? We're talking about self-defense. But we're talking about self-defense in a way that we don't ordinarily think about self-defense. The Gemara here, I believe, is pursuing a line of legal reasoning that really pushes the limit on the whole concept of self-defense. Not only about oneself being allowed to make sure one's life does not come into danger, lethal danger, but society, in terms of protecting a life, having some power as an extension of the individual who's being pursued. It's a little bit different, and I guess I'm going to ask this as a question. How or is this legal discussion we're about to enter, how is it reflective of the self-defense kind of legal philosophy, area of legal reasoning? And how is it also, and or opposed to that, how is it also a little bit like the Good Samaritan laws? I wonder, with legal minds in the room, and you know, people who have reflected a little bit about this, which is it really more like? What's the area of law that's being really pushed here? If I allow for witnesses to take the life, and by the way, I give them space to not deal with the same procedure that we normally hold has to be legally used to, quote-unquote, sentence someone to death. So I want to push into the sugya again with that question in mind, and I'd like some reflection about it.
I have a question about this.
Yeah, add to the question.
The question is, if the witnesses are killing, that's preventing, there are not more witnesses. You need to have other witnesses to see that.
But it's not purporting that. We could ad infinitum. No, it's purporting that those who have ascertained that this is a case of rodef, and davka specifically the lashon is of the Gemara Katan harodef, that Katan can be saved by killing this person. So we have a very specific case. Wondering about the areas of law that are being really explored. Look further now with me as the sugi unfolds. Think about those two brackets. Maybe there's another that will come up for you. Kesavar, here's what Rav Huna is thinking. Rodef, eno tzarich hatra'a. A rodef doesn't need any warning. Lo shna gadol v'lo shna katan. It doesn't matter whether he's an adult or a minor. Thus what? The one pursuing the other one may be killed at the given point where it's ascertained that we actually see that there's really a case of rodef here. The one is chasing the other to kill him. So, etve Rav Chista l'Rav Huna. But we have a challenge by Rav Chista on Rav Huna from a Mishnah, right? Indicated by the etve word, vis-a-vis Talmudic hermeneutics. Yatsar osho, once a baby's head has left the mother's body, ain no gin bo. We may not touch it. In other words, you cannot surgically remove the child in parts. Remember, we learned this Mishnah. We can't remove that child in order to save the mother's life. Right? This is Mishnah Olot. We had it on the sources before the So One May Live case. Right? We had it on Mishnah page that kind of looked like, you have it? No. You recall the Mishnah, just those of you who were here? Sort of. Let me remind you what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says that if a woman is giving birth and she comes into danger because of the valad, because of the child about to be born, what are we permitted to do? If the child's head has not come entirely out of the birth canal, then we are able to surgically remove the child, even limb by limb, in order to save the life of the mother. If the child's head has come out, then the child is considered a full human being, and one life is not exchanged for another. And thusly what? The mother, even if she is in harm's way, can't be saved by surgically removing this child. Now, this is obviously very real, ancient kind of consideration, childbirth being the dangerous moment that it was. But we take from that, and we learn over here to our situation, that if the head has come out, so says Rabbi Chista, as opposed to Rabbi Huna, I'm going to tell you that you're saying that the woman's in danger? The head's come out, though. If the head's come out, and this katan is considered a full person, then how could you possibly say that you could, in essence, now maintain that that is a rodef? I see that the woman's life is in danger. Wouldn't I define, according to the way you're thinking, Rabbi Huna, that this newborn is a rodef, and thusly, I have the right to take his life? So Rabbi Chista challenges from that way. But we don't push aside one person's life on account of another. So don't give me this learning about what it means to be a rodef. Va'amai, why not, though? Rodefu. In other words, he's now going to make the argument explicitly. According to your logic, he's a rodef. So take care of him. Shane hatam. But it's different there, the Gemara says. The mishmaya ka rodfele. And this is where we talk a little bit about how heaven is in pursuit of the woman, according to the way the Gemara's language works here, not the newborn him or herself. So therefore, even though her life is in danger, I can't call that newborn a rodef, a pursuer, a murderous pursuer. I have to now see it as a little bit different, that somewhere Shamayim, the heavens, God, made this situation like it is, and I have to, in essence, what?
Kill the baby.
The opposite. I have to let the mother die.
If the baby will be able to survive.
Oh, but so there's perhaps right. The complication. We don't really know from the way the Gemara's language works what the ultimate decision is going to be, because we're not there. But if we were there, and I believe the Gemara's language is somewhat short in this vein and not completely filled with detail, because it's the same, an equal and opposite side of the actual case of the rodef and the katan chasing the katan. What do I mean? The Gemara here is doing something very interesting to learn in these areas of law, whether it's, again, the self-defense or it's Good Samaritan. The Gemara is giving you, in essence, a case. In that case of the woman where that's happening, I don't define this child as a rodef. It seems, though, that the mother's life really is in danger here. So the fact of this case is a little bit more that the mother is in danger. Or else Reb Chista wouldn't really have what? He wouldn't have anything to lean on, vis-a-vis throwing this in Rabbi Huna's face. He's showing a case. He's bringing a case where, obviously, the mother is in danger. Or else he wouldn't really have an argument against Rabbi Huna. Even with that, says the Gemara, I can't really make the parallel. I have to see this as a very different situation. Is that because, A, the baby is not entirely a sentient human being and doesn't yet have any kind of dea, because we say that up till a certain age or day, 8 days, 30 days, depending on the kind of, if you will, flexibility of law and thinking at this point, is that child not really considered, you know, bechayim, because we're really talking about the birth moment? Is that what they're relying on? That's one way to look at the situation. Is it because, in general, young children below a certain age who haven't even reached potentially anywhere near bar mitzvah are considered as such? Well, that's, you know, a question here. But the only way Rav Chisda has an argument is if we do see this child as being life. So here is a position that obviously goes against any of the 8-day, 30-day kind of perspectives, right? He has to see this newborn whose head is out completely as a life. Where is he basing his philosophy? In the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Olot about this situation with the baby already says we don't exchange one life for another when a baby's head is out. Therefore, any thinking, have you heard this thinking, by the way, that 8 days, we wait 8 days and really say that the child is, quote-unquote, a valid life, or 30 days? But the Mishnah's philosophy, and here's something that this Gemara reveals, the Mishnah's philosophy is very much the moment the head is out, the baby's alive. And for families who deal with children and babies within the tradition, you know, I've seen both sides of the coin work, by the way, in a very real human way. One, the tradition that a baby's not yet entirely, you know, life the same way. For someone who really embraces tradition and really felt the pain there, they could kind of use that in their corner as an aid to not necessarily mourning or having the response in the way to this unfortunate death. On the other hand, a family who can't understand why you wouldn't really, in a very sacred way, see that child as having had some kind of moment of life to give a certain kind of sentience in the world or existence in the world, not just, you know, vis-a-vis the mother. I mean, we already know that we bury any kind of human-looking remains within the cemetery. That's not an issue. But the question here of when life really begins and at what point life can really be taken and at what point you really have someone who's considered a person in the world, again, not necessarily the point of our Gemara, but comes through in the Diyun.
I mean, I'm thinking of two different things. I mean, not only do we bury these children, but boy, we can give it a bris milah, and we can give it a name, right? And so there's that piece. But I think what's bothering me is that, is this really a pursuer, right? Or is the basic point that there are two things that can't coexist? Just like if there was enough food or water for one being, and there were two beings in a room, it doesn't mean that one of them is aggressively pursuing the other. Whereas in the last case, it was clearly a pursuer, right? In this case, it's just, can these things coexist same time? I don't necessarily.
So your answer to Shani Hatam, in other words, if Shani Hatam was, let's talk about how this differs, which Shani Hatam is a gateway to do in terms of the Mefarshim. So your answer might not be, well, this is a case where heaven somehow set this into motion in the way that it was versus this Rodef who's doing it with conscious murderous intent, right?
Right.
You're actually answering a different Shani Hatam. It's different over there. How's it different over there? Like this case you're bringing about people not having it. So that's perfectly, I think, a fine pathway to, you know, quote-unquote, be bothered and bring the kind of read of the text. We can see this as being the answer to the Gemara, but that's in of itself a little open to what does that really mean? And your read, I think, is pushing strongly on...
Right, I think in the last case, there was an active pursuer.
Right.
And again, I mean, this is kind of with English notes, right? The benefit of English notes is, you know, and they said that not only, and the reason why you were able to kill him, even as a minor, is because as a minor he didn't have the ability to say, yes, I heard the warning, and yes, I'm deciding to kind of not heed the warning.
Yeah, if by the way, that's in the note. That's not lechol deyot, right? That's not everybody's opinion about why it is, but it's definitely part of the natural kind of potential there, right?
But I think just in more general, I kind of go back to that. Is this being a pursuer?
Right.
Or is it just seeking to coexist?
Absolutely. And in that vein, let me just, in terms of the broader picture of why we study the details and why we go through, the Gemara as a refiner of thinking, is it the same or is it not? Back to Ron, your question before about even these other people. The Gemara wants us to be in this learning so that we're asking the question consistently, can I learn from one place to the other? This is an aspect of common law, and it's definitely legal within its framework, but it's also, whether it's scientific research these days or whether it's thinking in terms of intersecting points that scholars try to make within their work. That's the Gemara's project in many ways.
So to sort of tie it into the question that you asked and to try and make some sense of what's going on here, your question was, is this really a Good Samaritan? Is this self-defense? It doesn't really seem to be either, because where we started was Ben Sorer Morav, to skip all the detail, if you are in a situation where the circumstances are such that the thief is going to take your life, you can take the thief's life. Was that self-defense? No. It was for the benefit of the thief. Right? This is a person like the Ben Sorer Morav, who you're taking the life of the Ben Sorer Morav because he's going to grow up and he's going to kill people. And you don't want him to be a sinner, so you're doing it. You're doing them a favor by killing them. Same thing with the thief below. I think that the idea was you're helping him. The Rodef, we also, I think we learned that the purpose of taking the life of the Rodef is for his benefit, her benefit, the Rodef's benefit, not to save the life. You're not substituting the life of the pursued for the pursuer,
mm-hmm.
We learned. It's not to save the pursued's life. It's for the benefit of the pursuer, who is doing terrible things and will do more terrible things. So this infant,
mm-hmm.
If we say that what the Gemara is doing with these examples is giving us mm-hmm. what are the other circumstances where we take a life, and for what purpose, for what reason? I don't think we. It doesn't make sense here to say if this is supposed to be an example like the other examples,
mm-hmm.
you would take the life of the child
mm-hmm.
if you were doing it for the child's benefit. And that doesn't make any sense given the other examples, because if you have nobody except God, you would know whether this child is going to grow up to be an inveterate sinner, such that
mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, he's not a rodef. He's not any of these other examples. He's not responsible, and we don't know what's going to happen. So you don't take that life because you don't substitute one for another.
Right, right. So I call a kavod. We went back, asked about Ben Sora Amore. Where does that fit in again to this whole picture, right? And then the whole question of the Gemara asking. When also might we take a life based on what we see within the motivation, the mensrea, the criminal mindset of potential criminality that we define within the pursuer versus the victim. The only piece of that's a little difficult here, right, might be, and just playing this out, that nitan mahatzilo bin nafsho. We can save him, the one being pursued, bin nafsho, with the sentence of death that we execute upon the person who's chasing. But I think you're on to something with what is the motivation, what is the mindset of this kind of person who would do this, and therefore we might have to see this as a time to not be so, quote-unquote, stuck on our own procedure. If it's about hatra'ah, we either say he's a katan and therefore he can't understand it and he can't answer back and then we could kill him, as the note said, or we could say that even a katan who's never really held accountable for his actions, we should, A, be able to kill him on the spot because of this kind of notion of what we see going on here in society with this case, and have to rise up and do that, despite the fact that there's a warning. But there's no warning. But the question of there being a warning in and of itself is going to be brought by the Gemara. A. B, and I want to get to that piece now. And B, I think we so I hear you that you're suggesting that it's neither the self-defense nor the Good Samaritan. I want to then purport a third potential. Let's see, like with the next piece. And I'm not totally clear that I think it's neither of those, but I'll go with it for a second. Maybe the Gemara is simply investigating when and what a righteous vigilantism is all about. Somehow, in here, it's not the parents anymore. To go back to Ben Sorer More, because we read in a literary arc, in a narrative arc, just like you brought back the case of Ben Sorer More, I was going there afterwards, but I'll go now, just in terms of before we get to the next. I'm fascinated that it went from the arc of the parents who had this obligation, to two witnesses. It puts two witnesses to any given situation within the precincts and the community of Israel in a very important role. Two witnesses, of course, essential for a ketubah. Two witnesses, essential for delivery of a get, bill of divorce, decree. Two witnesses here being the quote-unquote Beit Din of the street. So I want to keep that in mind for any of the parallelism that it's relating to vis-a-vis the Ben Sorer Umare, the stubborn and rebellious child's case that we saw in the Torah itself, because remember the two parents really had to be of one mind, one voice. Remember you had to even push to, they had to be physically exactly alike, you know, remember all that. That ultimately there's an exploration here. Can two people really make this decision? When do we allow it? When does the street justice come into action versus procedural justice of the court system? Can we stand for that within our society? As a matter of fact, in many ways, that's the whole end of the perek. It's kind of a good hachdama, it's a good introduction, to the end of the perek, to the end. We're not going to give back to the child, nor his parents. That's not where we're going in the last couple pages of the chapter. So the next couple weeks, we're really in this Mishnah, and we're in a next Mishnah that says, by the way, here are some cases where you can also exercise lethal force in order to save somebody from their own transgression and or save the world from them committing this transgression. A little two different kind of modes. So
there's a legal concept of last clear chance, which I don't think is absolutely apropos, because it's usually in a tort situation. But if these witnesses had the last clear chance to prevent this pursuer from killing this person, they are required to do so.
Before they would act on using any kind of lethal force, or
no, to use lethal force to stop the pursuer.
Uh huh. So let me ask. Let me ask
if
you.
They have the last. What I say is the last clear chance.
In current law, can someone use lethal force to stop somebody else using lethal force in America?
No. It can be justified if that would have to
only the law.
Only in Texas.
Right. Depends on which city you're studying Talmud.
Right.
Yeah, from what I understand about what I read recently is that lethal force is only licensed, if you will, by the state. And that citizens' arrest...
What about stand your ground?
Right. So, what's that?
I think what you're saying is, can one person stop another person from killing a third person?
Right.
Correct.
Which is not
stand
your ground. Stand your ground is you
or your
and a pursuer. So it's Habava Machteret.
We saw actually in the Gemara already that they expanded it to a field.
Right.
But there's no case that I tried to do a little bit of looking in some places that I thought maybe prosecutors go, and I called one friend of mine who used to be an ex-prosecutor who became a rabbi, and I said, and I said, you know, is there a parallel in the American justice system, or has there been, to your knowledge, in the English common law system? And really, he couldn't think of the case. And that's why I say the exploration here is the exploration a very unique way of thinking about self-defense in the ancient world, which I thought happened because of the verse that was brought from the Noah story, which was the verse, Ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech, right? Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. And it kind of is bringing the whole scenario into, I don't want to overstate it, but the humanity of one individual extends to the two witnesses who make this determination enough to actually kill someone who is pursuing the third party. You know, it seems as though they're acting as a proxy or a shaliach for the person who's being chased.
Well, the closest thing, I think, in American history that we all have read about are lynchings.
How so?
Lynchings in the South, a group of people, more than one, generally white people, would accuse a black person of the black person doing something harmful, whether he was accompanying a white woman or raping a white woman or taking property, and they would lynch the black person.
So you kind of it's a kind of opposite situation, right, where they're blaming this person.
There was no crime.
The lynching was never permissible. It was never.
No, I understand it was never permissible.
Correct.
But it
was murder.
But that's what we're arguing here, that these two people, seeing someone pursue something, are making the judgment that that person pursuing the other person is a harmful person who has the intent to kill that other person. So to me, from what I've read of many scholars in the Civil War, it was flimsy evidence that the black person was doing something to harm, quote unquote, the white person. But the white crowd still felt that they had the right, without due process, to corral the black person and, in many cases, kill him.
So you're talking about a potential abuse of this law.
But that's the point.
Right.
This,
we're assuming
this
yeah,
is
but that's
the total potential for abuse.
Yeah.
I mean
that is inherent. The question exists here.
To me.
The question is definitely inherent within the facts.
What the problem is here is, I think what Warren may be trying to get at, I'm not sure, I don't want the words in my mouth, but if you see a fight occur and you see some pursuit going on and you're going to break that up, particularly if there are two of you, your intent is usually to break up the altercation and not kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So you break up the fight.
Right.
And, I mean, for all you know, the person being pursued may actually be the culprit. You don't know. Because you see somebody being pursued, you don't really know what happened. So either party can be guilty, they both can be guilty.
Right, right.
Because it could just be a feud.
So
you don't want to kill anybody.
Right.
You only kill somebody by a imminent.
So let's say that that's somewhat of a dilemma within the construct if you apply this law generally. Let's say here, for sure the rabbis thought, this is an obvious case, where the rodef, the one pursuing, is definitely going to kill the other. But just to make that distinction. But it's true that we're touching upon one very deeply problematic potential if this was taken into the street. And thusly, I think, again, that's why I suggested maybe it's an exploration in some way of vigilantism and just how much we either rely entirely on procedure and dragging that person to court
by the two of them applying their force? Or when do we really let this happen, that they define this person as a rodef and lahasilo bin afsho, to save this one by the other? Yeah.
I want to go back to something you've said a few times, which is that the reading of the text in the Talmud is perhaps intended to provoke us to think about not the specific details and minutiae of the arguments, but a much bigger picture.
Both end.
I don't think myself, from what I'm seeing, that these arguments were necessarily made with the idea that this should be actual de jure procedure, because, and as you pointed out, you know, two guys don't like somebody, and perhaps one of the witnesses is the party being pursued, so he and his friend. Because I think there's a lot of inconsistencies. We read earlier in the discussion about criminal cases, a man sees a man pursuing another man. That man runs into a building pursued by the pursuer, by the rodef. He runs in to try to help, and there the rodef now is standing with a bloody knife dripping, and the man he was pursuing is dead on the floor. No prosecution, because there were not two witnesses to the actual act.
No capital punishment.
Well,
nothing.
Well, he was chayav benafsho, right? We say that he should have paid for his life. He was going to pay for his life, but it's true that maybe there were going to be some other types of adjudication. So.
All right. So, in a case like that, if they had caught up with the rodef before he could chase the man into the building, they could have killed him. After the fact,
right.
It's like the tunneling burglar. If he's successful and escapes with the goods, he can't be pursued and murdered in his home. Only in the act of in this case, as I pointed out, I mean, it's not law; it's anti-law. It's vigilantism.
Well, right. That's it. And so I think though,
I've lived under a system.
Right. So in the bigger picture, that's the suggestion here, that there's an exploration of when the system fails, and what do you need for the system to succeed? If the outcome of the diyun and the dibor is that I can't potentially see this system working because of the place where we're arriving right now, they for sure don't want us to just close the book and stop the reading their argumentation. There's a reason why they're going to pursue this case to the end, to see what the detail really was that allowed us potentially in that one case to follow through with it, because maybe in one case or another it was followed through with, because you remember the guy who sat on the grave of the Ben Sorer Moray. But ultimately the case has to sometimes lead us back to procedure, the right procedure. So let's push forward and see where it goes. Oh, did you have, I'm sorry, Roberta, did you have one thing?
That's okay. No.
Okay, so let me bring you to this section of the Gemara here. And that is the warning again. Go to 272b5. If you're on the left column of the English, if you're there. And I'm going to go from Lo Tzricha. Lo Tzricha, okay? Do you have the Vilna there or the Steinsaltz?
I don't know.
You have the Steinsaltz? I don't know exactly where it is on the page there.
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay, good. So, Lo Tzricha. The warning in the Brightest case was necessary when Deka Batrei Ivrei Dinahara, where they were standing on opposite banks of the river, the pursuer and his intended victim on one side and the witnesses on the other. So it gives you a case where you're having this river divided. Delo matza atzole, so that the witnesses were not able to save the victim's life by killing that pursuer. So where did I need a warning over there? I needed a warning when the case was that they were divided by some which way, shape, form, that didn't allow them to actually follow through on saving this one being pursued by killing the pursuer. Now, we're interested in what should the witnesses really do if they really can't save him with the cost of the pursuer's life. Ma'ika, what now? What is there for the witnesses to do now? Right? They didn't completely save. They needed to make a warning. So do they have any further obligation if they didn't actually follow through with the killing? And ultimately, given our bigger picture discussion, don't we want witnesses to be thinking like this? You know, maybe it's like not exactly a physical river. You know, there's space between me and this situation. But what is my obligation now according to the law? My obligation is as follows. Devai ta'iye levedina. They have to bring that pursuer to a court of justice. Their responsibility is to actually bring them to the court. Okay? And it says, the Breita's case, according to the English notes, and remember sometimes I say we have to read the English notes to see how their reading is happening versus other readings. Accordingly, the witnesses in the Breita's case issued a legal warning so that the pursuer could be executed by the courts. Meaning what? Their read is that enough was satisfied so that the courts, of course, would have what? Sentenced the guy to death. And therefore, any good court that would have sentenced him to death knows that it's any which way, because remember we had a limud in the Gemara that said, if by man your blood shall be shed, by the man shall his blood be shed. He was able to be executed in any way if the punishment that the Beit Din actually prescribed wasn't even available at the moment. So any which way, the person was already chayav mita. He was already obligated a death sentence. So why did they want to do that? Why did the Gemara want to go there? Because ultimately they're still a little uncomfortable with Rav Huna's statement that this katan, this minor, could be pursued and that a rodef could just be killed by these witnesses deciding on the spot. They had to get to a place to say, what is the real responsibility? Now it's true, Rashi says about the Nahar, about the river, Rashi says, no, it is really talking physically. The river being between these guys and the actual places that they are standing is far away enough from each other that I now have to tell the witnesses. But if they're far away from each other on both sides of a river, right, aren't they far away enough to not really catch the guy who's chasing after the other to actually bring it to court? I mean, what's being said if it's really about a river and it's really about standing on two sides? I think the language of the Gemara, and this I get from, again, literary understandings of the language of Gemara versus the, like, let's say, pshat, simplest sense, that they're a river apart from what? From the law that I'm going to actually rise up and take justice into my own hands here. I know what the law is. This guy's pursuing. I'm going to bring them to the Beit Din. The Beit Din is going to act on this. We can say as witnesses, we've given the requisite warning according to our Torah law, and they're going to pay. Nice. So you want to say temporal and time? Good. And the current of the river being the kind of active notion. Of course, the Gemara wants Rav Huna to have his say.
I'm going with Rashi. What the significance is, if this literally is the river, because that's what he wants to do. And if that is the case, the consequence is that you cannot be right next to it and that you have to pursue this after the moment and make sure justice is done.
Okay, so you're saying that it's an afterwards and you're on the opposite side for real, and you better now bring them to court, report them to the authorities, etc. You know, like some people could ignore reporting things to the authorities.
Absolutely. If you know about it, then this is, you know, also responsibility, a moral responsibility for knowing that this person exists and that this crime exists.
Nice.
I'm not understanding. Is your reading that this is not about the witnesses taking the life, but that they're supposed to bring the person to court?
Right. That it's a way to arrive, especially with Rabbi Chista, who challenged Rav Huna, it's a way to arrive at saying, no, our procedure is the one that really should be followed.
Taken to court.
You know, they are going to put words in Rabbi Huna's mouth. Rabbi Huna says the following, depending on how you want to know it, Ibayit Ema, but if you prefer to say, though, that Rabbi Huna would answer this way. And now the Ibayit Ema, again, like, I love Gemara's way of presenting what people are going to say sometimes with the small language, the Aramaisms, the editorial content, because it's saying, Ibaidema, if you want to say, you know, if there's a desire to say that Rabbi Huna wanted to hold his position, remember what Rabbi Huna said, that the one who's the Katana Rodeth, the small minor one, can be killed if he's pursuing it, according to Rashi, another small minor. Here's what Rav Huna would say. What I said is valid according to the Tana of a Braita who's talking about what? The Machteret. Who's talking about the case of Hababa Machteret. Who's talking about the case of the one who's tunneling in. The Amar Machtartozu hi Hatarato. That the actual tunneling in is in essence fulfilling the obligation of the warning. Meaning what? That if someone's in a tunnel,
he knows his risk to the life.
He needs to say, I know what the law is, and I'm still going to follow through with it. We see that as a pretty plain expression of what the system calls for. And that is, if you were going to tell him, excuse me, you know that that's against the law, and you know that when the owner of the house comes forward to protect his goods and family, he's willing to even use lethal force to kill you. And he says, I'm still going to do it anyway. I understand the law. Simply by being in that, quote-unquote, tunneling in, which is, again, expansively trespassing on someone's defined private property, according to the way we looked at Gemara a little couple classes ago. That's enough of a warning.
Sorry, again, I'm just on the facts. In this situation where they've warned them the river is there and so on, what happens next? Were they taken the life of the Nidav? What are they bringing him to court for? Murder or intending to murder?
Yeah, so that's a standing question. Right? So I have seen it both ways. That A, there's murder that happened, and therefore two witnesses can testify to the fact that it indeed happened, and whether you look at it as Bobby explained, that even after the fact they have to go and they have to bring them to the authorities themselves, or B, they have to go and report it to the authorities so that the authority comes with the shomrim, with whatever the enforcers are. And then there's the question of, did it actually happen? And I forget who it was. It's either Yad Avraham or the Rosh. But the question is, did it really occur? What are they, exactly your question, what are they really bringing him to court for? And do we have such a thing as the intention to murder? So I guess again, legal minds here. You have intended murder. You have charges that you can be brought up on for intended murder. That's an ancient kind of system. We don't really see necessarily that the case is brought out, except to say, v'shem sofo, for what he will do in the end, he is killed. So if you go back to Ben Sorer Moreh, and you go back to some of the cases where we allow for the court to sentence someone to death, we do see that intentions or future actions can be brought into the shikul hadat, into the diyun, into the judge's discretion when it comes to meting out penalties and punishment.
The English translation of the Gemara says you bring him to court only if you could not prevent the Rodef from killing his...
That's what the English translation says.
Well, that's not much actual text. Not really.
I mean, that is a read that they have through the sources.
If you are studying this subject as the Rodef and what you can do to a Rodef, then it has to be a circumstance where you have taken the life of the Rodef, that must be what the question is, before the Rodef has killed the pursued. Otherwise, you're just dealing with the world of murder. I mean, every killing, the person who's killed without some justification is called a murderer, and they, you know, if the procedure is followed, that's just a nitzah or a rotzeach. So I thought that rodef is like a separate category of a person who is pursuing someone else to kill them. Mm-hmm. You know that. You're allowed to take that person's life.
Before the crime is
Well, if he commits the crime, then he's a murderer.
And then he's the other case. Right.
So the Nahar, the river preventing the two people from preventing the murder, so it's, I don't know, to me it's not a case of a rodef anymore.
You know what's fascinating about, do you read now? Let's say we pushed that in this sugya. Let's say we go with your thinking for a second, that we're talking about not a case of the murderer per se, that he followed through like it says in the English. Let's say that we're going with the case where he was a rodef. That's equivalent to what? Hababa machteret. The one who tunnels in. What's the one who tunnels in now judged as? What's that? Doesn't need a hatra. He doesn't need that procedure. Even though it says here that they actually delivered a warning because they were on the other side of the river, we could even say that they don't even need it because according to Rabbi Huna and his svar at the end of the sugya, the svara is, the thought is, machtarato hatra, that his tunneling is the warning itself. Keep going with the thought. If it's about a rodef and the fact that I'm going to bring that rodef to court, it's indicative of the way we might be able to treat Hababa Machteret, which was a problem for all of us over the weeks here. What's the problem with Hababa Machteret, the one who comes in through the tunnel? If he escapes and if he gets out, can we go get him? It didn't give us any procedure to actually go get him. But now if we go with your reading that the case is about Rodef without the Retzach, without the murder, and I learn back to the one who comes in through the tunnel, and I say, since I can bring the Rodef to court, because I know that he's already Chayav B'mita, he's already Chayav B'nafsho, he's already sentenced to death because of the fact that he's just like one who comes in through the tunnel, then the one who came in through the tunnel, who took all this property, who is obligated to pay with his life back at that time, if the person rises up, what can I do? Taken to court.
Well,
not the system that we actually learn out. It's not but it's like the move of what the Rishonim do when it comes to learning within the pages of Talmud. Lahavdil. It's a very interesting thought when it comes to answering our koshi, our kind of difficulty when it came to just this guy kind of gets off with the property.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the tunneling situation is, if you're allowed to pursue somebody and you say, and I'm sorry, so somebody who is tunneling, is somebody who is robbing it, if they just kind of broke a window and did something brazen, maybe they weren't so aware of just what was happening. But because they went to the extreme to tunnel and to kind of to be covert, they don't need a warning because they're kind of a sophisticated burglar. Right? They knew exactly what they were doing, and they need them. This is different. This is somebody killed somebody. They did what they did. We haven't seen that they went through, you know, kind of any way to put on a disguise or to make it look like somebody else that they murdered.
By the way, we were even saying that they're chasing somebody and they were determined to be a Rodef. We put them in the category of a murderous chaser versus actually having committed the killing itself. That's where we're holding right now vis-a-vis the
right, strong man. But we're still saying just because one person's chasing the other, the witnesses have this, quote, moral obligation to say, hey, you, here's what the law is. Are you aware of the law? You're breaking the law. Yes, I'm aware of the law, and I'm choosing to break the law. Okay, I could kill you. Right? This is, they've gone through something. We don't know. Maybe the person was just acting at the heat of the moment or something. But I think that, to me, there's a distinction between...
You could make that as the answer to the potential of what we suggested, given this read of learning from the road that back to Habavamah theory.
Right.
You could say, but in this case, it doesn't seem to be with us much kavanah for both breaking and entering and potentially fighting for your life with the killing of the homeowner vis-a-vis the Baba Mahkar, because you could say that definitely. Yeah, Roberta, let's...
So, some of the cases, like the case of the childbirth, those seem like very real cases that were current and clear. Common, real. Whereas this case seems very hypothetical. And then I'm wondering, did the rabbis kind of conjure up this hypothetical case with the intention, not so much of, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm looking for some, was this possibly conjured up to deliver some other kind of teaching to the people?
So I think we're between both of those. The teachings are about potentially, you know, large questions about law and how we apply them on an individual basis versus utilizing our system and staying within the system as we are kind of trying to evidence, you know, when is it right to make the decision as a witness? And with the river between them, you know, that somehow there's this physical distance, so what are my obligations now that I know that there's this immoral character in the world? Do I have to report them to the authorities? Do I have to not? That could be about any case, not just about one person chasing another to kill them. It could be about anything that's maybe gone wrong within society itself, right? But then there are the cases themselves, and there are details about those cases. We don't say necessarily that they're just there as straw men.
Mm-hmm.
That there are certain times, and the Gemara itself, it kind of brings in the voice of a chacham, often times here in our parakeet as well, to say, look, you guys think this is only theoretical, lo haya lo yiye, it never was, it never will be, but I sat on the grave of a stubborn and rebellious son. So, again, like you could say that, don't discount it, right? Could be, or you could say, yeah, I actually once saw that.
Thing that, I mean, to me, this is only interesting if the circumstances that he's declared his intention to kill the pursuer,
right.
He declared his intention to kill while he's having this conversation or whatever, the pursuer runs away. There's been no killing, and what the Gemara is saying is that person is chayav something or other, maybe death.
Right.
Bring him to court, and by the way, that's our law. Because if you do an attempted murder,
right.
You haven't murdered, you're liable for slightly less than the penalty
right.
for murder.
Right.
That's our law.
Right.
So
attempted murder.
That wouldn't be shocking.
Right.
That would be a ruta.
Is actually to protect the. Protect the punisher of the Rodef. In the same way that someone who tunnels into your home, you're asleep and you don't funny, I think I there's somebody downstairs. You
right.
Come down, and there's a guy coming out of the air conditioning
right.
vent, and you panic and you shoot the guy.
Right.
And it turns out he's unarmed, and maybe he was just drunk, whatever.
Right.
And in this case, a man is pursuing another man, and the man is going to help me, help me. He's trying to kill me. You jump the guy and beat him to death to disarm him. You could be charged with murder. So it, in a sense, protects people who react, as you said, in the heat of the moment. After the fact, you could not be justified after the fact to go to the guy's house who robbed you and shoot him.
Right, right.
You can go to the court and say...
So what is that law? What is that category of law?
I'm not a lawyer. What is that category of law?
Doesn't that sound a little bit like Good Samaritan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Except that Good Samaritan doesn't go that far in our Western systems. So what I find interesting on a theoretical basis is that over here, it's like if someone adds a third party to the Cain and Abel story, to the Cain and Abel story for a minute. If someone saw Cain rise up, they could have taken his life. The whole world would have been different if there were just some witnesses.
No, I think it would be different for me. I don't know about the world.
To me, that river... It's not physical and it's not temporal, it's emotional. And the two witnesses are looking for a path to not have to stand up and enter into this very challenging situation, which could potentially change their lives. Because whether they do end up going to court with one person, they've entered into a whole process that they didn't seek to. If they don't go to court with the person, I don't know how they capture the person. That's still evasive to me, and no one's mentioned that as a problem. And the rabbis didn't seem to think that someone who kills someone doesn't just stay around to wait to be captured. So that doesn't make sense to me either.
It just happened today in London.
Okay. And
2,000 years.
But, thank you. And then, so the two people who are emotional, they want emotional distance from this challenging situation, and so it won't change their lives. And I think that if we want to bring it to very contemporary language, of course, all we have to do is talk about Penn State, where adults, time after time again, knowingly would not walk across that. I'm sorry, you can't walk across a river. Sorry. People would knowingly not cross a river. And they didn't. And they had multiple opportunities because they knew it would change their lives, even if it never became more public.
That's right.
And I don't understand where that's brought in. I mean, to me, that's the interpretation, mine, Laura's, but... Where's that?
Well, that's I'm suggesting, and so to the literary, deep literary readers of Gemara in today's Beit Midrash world, right? Our Beit Midrash world, can see within that term. If we're pushing for a read of what that river's all about, it's in essence there. And whether or not you have this moral obligation to actually use and pursue them through the systems of justice you have, I think is the deep moral question within this. I want to learn the next Mishnah before we break, because the next Mishnah is going to send us off to the next and last several pages over the next couple of weeks, and it's worth seeing this Mishnah and letting it brew somewhat, and it's worth knowing that it's, you know, going to touch on some nerves, potentially. It's going to give you the worldview of the rabbis. We have to try to understand more deeply what the worldview of the rabbis really was when they even talked about these areas, but we're not going to go entirely into that this evening. But for sure they have their sense of what these actions are all about in the world. The Mishnah on 73a. Okay? Matnitin. So when you have the Mem Tov Nun Yud with a chipchik with a little thing in the Vilna edition, it is Matnitin. And it's verbal and not our Mishnah per se. It's our Mishnah on the one hand, and it also says our teaching orally went like this. Okay? These are those whom we save at the cost of their lives. Okay? Rashi says, Min ha'avera. So Rashi's take on this is that we save these people from transgressing and committing a sin by actually taking their lives. Here are they. HaRodef achar chaveiro lahargo, one who's pursuing his fellow to kill him. So why do we actually save him? As Dan said, here's the Mishnah that said, we save him from the aveira that he was going to commit. That's at least Rashi's view on the Mishnah. There are others, but that's it. Next, va'achar hazachar, and one who runs after a male to sodomize him, we kill him for that he would commit an aveira. My teacher, Brad Artson, wrote the article about how we are to understand this kind of approach within Torah itself and within the Mishnah, so that it's not simply the act of sodomy in a kind of relational way, but that it is the act of sodomy,
rape sodomy,
in terms of rape and or in a fashion that was to please other gods in systems of foreign worship. Okay, so two different pieces here could be that one is pursuing a person to rape, and therefore we would kill the one who's transgressing. But since we say, according to Rashi's read, that it's about his potential aveira, what is the aveira? How can I possibly understand this? If I want to understand in the context of Torah and this Mishnah, and that is that A, it could be that he's doing this lewd act simply for the fact that it's a lewd act purely for pleasure, you know, over and against this notion of simply, you know, Dionysian pleasure and then the world of Greek physicality and carnality, or even more so, that it's an aveira against God, and through this act, I'm actually doing some type of worship, idol worship, pagan worship, through this sex act. And then, it adds one more category, ve'achar hana'ara ha'me'orasa, or after a betrothed na'ara to violate her. And of course, this is an issue of Eshet Ish, of sometimes, other times not necessarily, that you have the understandings of when a Na'ara is betrothed by most authorities that she's absolutely connected to her husband already, whether or not a betrothed Na'ara fully is in that category of being wed is philosophically and technically dealt with in Masechet Kedushin and other places, but we don't have to get into the technicalities. It's basically that you're committing adultery, and that it's not even about the adultery part. It could be that the motivation of the pursuer was actually simply rape for its sake and to make this person disgusting in the eyes of her groom-to-be. So what are the three topical areas we're dealing with? We're dealing with the obvious hariga, murder, retzach. We're dealing with life, the taking of life. We're dealing with sexual crimes when it comes to the na'ara, and therefore more proof that we're dealing with avodah zara in a very deep way, foreign worship, when it comes to the zachar case, and not simply the case of sexual transgression. There are those who will read it shot, of course, simple sense, and we can't avoid that kind of reading, that through the ages, the act of sodomy in and of itself was considered an aveira and a transgression, understood in its way as being, you know, quote-unquote, the way a man lies with a woman. And for the reality of that, in and of itself, one could take the pshat of the Mishnah as simply saying, we don't accept this type of either, you know, for the rabbis, reality that men would want or could do that with men, we disallow it. You know, there's nothing here philosophically about whether it's a choice about of a way of life or they understood it to be a natural cohabitation mode for human beings. We really don't see much of that foray, that discussion within our sources, despite the fact that for ages, right, that seemed to be the kind of central debate within the homosexual discussion. That's really not apparent within rabbinic parlance or Torah parlance. What was understood for ages was that it was simply a transgression to lie with a man like you would with a woman. And then acts of sodomy were disallowed, of course. And if you go with Rabbi Artson's read that we're talking about a very specific type of either absolute kind of rapier of male to male, or it was dealing with avodah zarah, particularly in the context of the discussion of both Torah and then here in the Mishnah, you see why the rabbis are going to relate to the three areas down below. The next part of the Mishnah, in fact, deals with some type of out of the bounds, but not as severe, sexual transgression. They're going to deal with idol worship, and they're going to deal with desecration of the Sabbath. So those three, if there's any parallel back to the top, we've got to try to find out where the parallel lies, right? So sexual transgression, obviously, with the na'ara, with the young girl who's betrothed, is out and out this kind of sexual transgression. B, avodah zarah, one who's about to engage in idol worship, is going to be this kind of zachar reality. And C, so how does the Sabbath parallel up to the taking of a life, right? Well, right, right. And in certain cases, yes, and in certain cases, no. I mean, lots of different cases come together, and we can kind of see the whole group as being relative to each other. But I think that, Adam and Chava are given life day six, and if there's no Sabbath, the question is, what really is humanity without the Sabbath in and of itself, hearkening back to creation? And this is one line of suggested thought about understanding the Sabbath vis-a-vis the whole situation of murder, that you can't really be in life and understand your place in this world if you don't really have life and work and toil and Sabbath following it. So the desecration of Sabbath becomes, in essence, the life-giving vessel that's provided for humanity. The Mishnah introduces us to this third, these three, this after the first three, where you may take one's life, the Mishnah in the second part says, but you can't take the life of people who are going to do the following. To be specific again, the Mishnah provides the partial list that may not be killed to prevent them from sinning. Aval ha-rodef achar behema, the one who pursues a beast for the purpose of sodomy is not killed, unlike the situation above. V'ha-michalel et ha-shabbat, or one who's about to desecrate the Sabbath, is not killed, though we killed the one who is rodef achar chavero, lohorgo, the one who's pursuing his friend to kill him. And v'oved avodat kochavim, the one who's about to do, what is avodat kochavim, miluli, translated? Idol worship, it's avodat kochavim, it's the worship of the stars. And idol worship in that sense is not simply, a statue that stands in front of me. We're more sophisticated about what we know in terms of basing our predictions of the world through the reading of constellations and those kinds of bodies as well. It can be seen as, quote-unquote, the idols and the representations of God and the realities of God in the world versus simply the transcendent God of the universe, right? Ein matilino tam benafsham, we may not save any of these people from sinning at the cost of their lives. So, go ahead.
It seems to me that I'm interpreting this as saying that the second group is worse sins than the first, because you're doing them a favor by killing them, so they don't commit this transgression. It seems to me they're saying the second group is so, that sins are so bad that you don't want to do them, you deserve all the punishment for doing the sin.
So a little counterintuitive, but very interesting by way of the philosophy that we saw pages ago that said, I'd rather have them killed now, right? So that they shouldn't go before the Kodesh Baruch Hu with any of the lichlu, with any of the dirt, the sin dirt on their soul, and I should have them.
You're doing them a favor by killing them with the first group. The second group, they're so bad, you shouldn't help them out at all.
Interesting take.
It's going to be the Sabbath, and it's going to be the idol worship.
I wanted us to get to the Mishnah tonight because the next few pages are going to explore this Mishnah, the whys and wherefores of why this category, not that category. It's going to do a lot of hermeneutical looking. We have several weeks left in our path. We're going to finish the Perek and make a seum and eat Chava, I understand, again. And so, see you next. I said, have a little scotch.
Don't worry.
And so see you next week. Sure,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.